Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts, or get bonus podcast episodes by supporting the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Welcome to a full-length episode of Sarah's Bookshelves Live. Today's guest is Liz Moore, the author of the new novel Long Bright River, which came out on January 7th. One of the subgenres of books that I've been loving recently are literary mysteries, and Long Bright River falls into this category. To me, it really felt like a literary police procedural crossed with a family drama. You've heard me talk about it on the Winter 2020 book preview episode and with Brittany Block on mini episode, so you know how much I loved this book. Moore's short fiction and creative nonfiction have appeared in venues such as Ten House, The New York Times, and Narrative Magazine. She is the winner of the Medici Book Club Prize and Philadelphia's Athenaeum Literary Award. She lives with her family in Philadelphia and is a faculty member of the MFA program in creative writing at Temple University. And Long Bright River is her fourth novel, and it was also a December Book of the Month pick, so I know many of you got it in your hands way back in December. Welcome, Liz.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled that we could fit this in. I know you are extremely busy and about to kick off book tour, and Christmas is coming. So we are recording right before Christmas, and I'm thrilled that we could fit this in.
No, I'm happy to.
For those who have not read Long Bright River yet, can you briefly tell us what the book is about?
Sure. Long Bright River is the story of two sisters living in a neighborhood called Kensington in Philadelphia. One is suffering from opioid addiction and has begun to do sex work to fund her addiction, and she's living on and off the street. And the other is a police officer who patrols the same district that the first one inhabits. And at the start of the book, there's a series of murders of women who are sort of the same demographic as the younger sister, Casey. And so her older sister, Mickey, begins to kind of go looking for her because she's disappeared. And Mickey's search for Casey takes her on and off the job. And she starts to kind of figure out that things might not be what they seem within the police department as well.
You've written four books that span quite a range of topics. You've covered the New York City music scene, virtual reality, and an unlikely friendship. And now we're on to the opioid crisis. How do you come up with all of these very different topics for your books? It doesn't seem like you have one niche that you stay in.
I think there's a couple of different ways I think about a book when I begin to write it. And one is every one of my books has been set in a different place. And I think of each book as sort of influenced by place very much. So my first novel was set in Manhattan, which is where I was living at the time. And I was playing music in a lot of small venues around the city and working in a small guitar store. And so that book was set in and around Manhattan and sort of like the music industry in Manhattan. My second book was very much influenced by Brooklyn, which is where I was living when I began to write it. I also have a family history in Brooklyn. My grandparents lived there from about the 1960s onward. So when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, that's where they were living. And then The Unseen World is set in Boston. That's my Boston book. I grew up in the suburbs of Boston, and both of my parents worked there. And finally, Long Bright River is set here in Philadelphia, and so which is where I've been living for about a decade. Each one of my books, I think, kind of has grown organically out of a place, and I've let that place influence every other facet of the book. So my Boston book, for example, came very much out of the kind of like academic world of Boston, which both of my parents worked in. And therefore, it took on kind of a speculative edge because it dealt very much with computer science and computing. The world I live in Philadelphia is very multifaceted. You know, there's the side of Philadelphia that's wonderful and burgeoning and blossoming and drawing a lot of tourists to it, and it's sort of like a city on the rise. And then there's another part of Philadelphia that's in which I do community work, and I have done for about a decade, that's still really struggling with the repercussions of the opioid crisis. And the sense of place of Kensington is sort of what influenced me to take the book in the direction it took. So I never like set out to write like, now this will be my speculative fiction book, this will be my police procedural. It's sort of just like, however the place influences the rest of the book is what the book ends up being, I guess.
And I think the sense of place in Long Bright River really shines through. And that totally makes sense about how you come up with your inspiration, because it really did feel just so devastating, but also vibrant in a way.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I really love that about Long Bright River. And can you tell us a little bit more about the work that you did in Kensington, and how I'm gathering that it sort of ended up being the research for this novel?
Yeah.
And how that impacted and what you learned from that, that you really wanted to make sure shined through in Long Bright River?
Yeah. So much of the research for Long Bright River was pretty organic. It wasn't like formal research the way I've done for other books. I initially was brought to the neighborhood in about 2009 by a friend of mine who's a photographer named Jeffrey Stockbridge, who's been working on portraits of the residents of Kensington and of the neighborhood itself for longer than I have. And he has a series of photographs called Kensington Blues. And back when I first moved to Philadelphia, he knew I was a writer, and he invited me up to the neighborhood to sort of conduct interviews of his subjects. And at the time, it really was not getting a lot of press. I mean, the opioid crisis in general was not getting nearly as much press as it's getting today. So I was very surprised by what I saw.
And if you Google Kensington today, a lot does come up.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. His work is, I think, really powerful. And it was a powerful experience for me to speak with his subjects. So I went up there a handful of times with him in 2009. And then we sort of went our separate ways, but both continued to work in the neighborhood. I ended up writing some nonfiction sketches about the neighborhood, just kind of keeping a diary about my visits there, and ultimately ended up teaching a free writing workshop at a Women's Day shelter in Kensington.
Oh, wow.
Which was housed under the auspices of an organization called St. Francis Inn, which is a really wonderful organization that provides food and a lot of necessary services to the residents of Kensington. So that put me in contact with a lot of people who were suffering from the effects of opioid addiction and just sort of in survival mode. I spent a lot of time thinking about how and whether to kind of tell a story set in Kensington, and had difficulty because the first character who came to me was Casey, but I never really found a voice that felt authentic for her. I have family history of addiction, which I think is sort of one of the main sparks of the novel in terms of the characters and the sort of relationships between all the characters. But I have never been addicted to opioids myself. And so I found it very difficult to write authentically in Casey's voice. And so I think Mickey arrived as sort of a vehicle that allowed me an entry point into the story in a way that felt more authentic to me, because I have more in common with Mickey than I do with Casey. So that's how she was born. And then that's kind of how the book was born. And then I spent several years writing the actual novel.
So when you started working with the photographer, did you already have in your head that you might want to write about this neighborhood, or did that come later after you started working with him and spent time there?
I think anytime you put a writer near a situation that feels very tense and emotionally fraught, it's kind of inevitable that the writer will want to process that through writing. And so, as I said, like the first writing I did about Kensington was nonfiction. I was just sort of keeping a diary, and ended up publishing a photo essay with Jeff probably 2012 in a book by a small press called The Head in the Hand. The book was called The Rust Belt Rising Almanac. So our work appears together only there.
Right.
I initially wrote a short story that I never published. It didn't feel like it was working. But in that short story were the characters of Mickey, Casey, Mrs. Mann and Thomas, only those four characters. And so that was sort of like the birth of the novel. And I put that short story aside for a while, but it kept kind of like calling me back, those characters in that world. And so when I had finished the writing of The Unseen World, I really in earnest kind of started what would become the novel of Long Bright River.
And you mentioned earlier that you at one point had maybe some reservations about whether you wanted to write this book or not when you were working there. Did I hear that right? And can you tell me a little bit more about those?
You know, you just always want to make sure that you're doing justice to any situation that has so much emotional weight to it.
Sure.
You know, I've met people that I really care about, and I have met people that are really suffering greatly, both people with addiction themselves and their family members. And I think what eventually convinced me that this was a book that I wanted to write is my kind of like everybody has a personal story connected to addiction, including me. So
right.
I feel like although this is fiction, there's certainly an autobiographical spark to it that I will not ever get too much into detail about, but
right, fair.
Suffice it to say, you know, it comes naturally to me to write about addiction as well. It's early days in the, you know, the book hasn't even been published yet, but I have a feeling that I will come into contact with a lot of people who have personal stories about addiction because it's so widespread. I mean, it's really almost unavoidable. Almost everybody I meet knows somebody with addiction, whether it's to opioids or alcohol or other substances. It's kind of a universal theme.
Absolutely. And I do feel like you wrote about Casey and the other opioid addicts with a level of certainly frustration that is normal for somebody that, you know, has somebody close to them that's addicted, but also compassion, and that those two mm-hmm. things just kind of push and pull against each other. And I think you really captured that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So you said you became, you know, friends with some of these people. Have you been back, and do they know that you've written this book? Do they know that it's out there in the world? How do they feel about it?
There is one individual in particular who has a long ongoing battle with addiction, who is very helpful, and I have gotten to know fairly well. And she has a copy of the book, as do a lot of, I guess I shouldn't say a lot, two of the people who work at St. Francis Inn, who I've gotten to know over my time there, and Director of Women in Transition, which is another organization I've done work with. And, you know, I've gotten feedback from some, not others. Like,
right.
To be fair, finished copies of the book arrived about a week to 2 weeks ago. So I'm right. still kind of waiting for feedback if I ever get any. And I may not ever get any, you know. I think everybody reacts to things differently, and we'll see.
So I want to talk a little bit about your writing process, because this was the first, I'll call it mystery, that you've written, correct?
Yeah.
How did that change your writing process from how you worked with your previous novels, or did it change it at all?
So I said yes when you asked if this is my first mystery, which is true in a sense. I mean, this is the first book that's really being categorized as right. like a police procedural or literary suspense or detective fiction or whatever you want to call it. But I think with at least the most recent three books that I've written, Heft to the Unseen World and Long Bright River, all of them have had a kind of mystery at their heart. So I have gotten used to working with the idea of reveals or missing information that is discovered.
Right.
Neither Heft nor The Unseen World was categorized as a mystery, but both of them contained sort of like a search that more and more characters was undergoing, and then sort of like the results of that search. So in that sense, I've had some practice, but this is definitely the first book I've written with a police officer character, and therefore I had to be quite aware of the conventions of the genre of police procedurals.
Right.
And kind of work within them and also work against them in certain ways. I really like reading detective fiction, and I love a lot of television and film, detective TV and film.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm pretty aware of the tropes of the genre and deeply respect when a book can really come up with like a twist or a reveal that feels earned and also surprising.
Yes.
Like, you never want to feel like a big reveal comes from outer space and you're like, wait a second, that doesn't feel like a correct revelation because it's not an earned revelation. So I think what I always try to do, whether it's in an actual mystery like this book or in my other fiction, is make sure that any big reveal feels correct for the characters in the book.
You just nailed my biggest, I guess, characteristic I look for in a mystery or a thriller, and also the biggest thing that can completely turn me off to the same type of book. And I think that's one of the reasons I loved Long Bright River. And you probably don't know this about me, my listeners do. I've had a lot of trouble with thrillers, and I'm not even going to say Long Bright River is a thriller because it didn't feel that way. It felt more mystery to me. But, mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why these outlandish twists that, while surprising, kind of don't make sense with the story or come out of nowhere. And I think it's such a tough thing to do, to ride the line of surprising, yet also it makes sense in hindsight. And that's one of the things I loved about Long Bright River.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad that it worked for you.
Oh, it did. Yes. And I'm not going to say more about it because I don't want to ruin it for anyone that hasn't read the book. And I want to ask you about the title, because I love, kind of when I'm reading a book, finding the place where the title comes from. And when mm-hmm. I found mm-hmm. the place where Long Bright River comes up in the book, I was shocked. It was not at all what I expected it to be. Can you tell everybody what exactly the title refers to and how you came up with that as the title?
So the title for this book was impossible to find. I had like four other working titles that I will never share because I knew that they were bad even as I titled the book then.
I was just going to ask you to share them.
No, I can't. It's too embarrassing.
That's fine.
And even like other readers of the book knew it was bad and told me as much. And I was always just kind of like, I know, just they're placeholders. Just give me some time. So at one point, I think I had pretty much the final draft of the book in place and I still didn't have a good title. I spent like two full work days, 8-hour days, just reading through as many works of poetry and prose that I could find that had anything to do with the theme of addiction or opioid addiction or heroin addiction or opium addiction, as the case ended up being. And I found this poem by Tennyson, who, as I will mention later, is not actually a poet I love. I don't particularly love most of his work, but I found an interesting biographical fact about him, which is that he lost a brother to an opium overdose. And I thought that was interesting. And he has a poem called The Lotus Eaters, which is one of the epigraphs of Long Bright River. And in that poem, there is a phrase about a long, bright river softly flowing as one of the many metaphors he uses for what it feels like to be under the influence of opium. And I thought the phrase long, bright river was really beautiful sonically and also had so many, it was like a lightning bolt, like it had so many immediate connections for me to the story. So one is the Delaware River, which was sort of the foundation of the neighborhood of Kensington and serves in the book as a kind of symbol of something outside of the daily grind of life, just sort of like a river that has that predates the neighborhood and will post-date the neighborhood.
That's what I went into it thinking the title was going to refer to.
Yeah. So it's one, that's one thing, and it does to a certain extent. And then it shows up a second time as a reference to a vein Casey is using.
Yes.
That describes the Long Bright River of her vein. And then a third time toward the end of the book is in reference to the Long Bright River of departed souls that have been lost to
yes.
overdose. And all of those references I sort of inserted after I had found the phrase.
Oh, interesting.
Because I found them so resonant. And that's how the title of the book came to be.
The thing about the vein was the mm-hmm. point when it really jumped out at me that that was the title. I think I actually missed the first one. And then I do remember the one at the end. But the vein was really the one that I was like, wow, that is not what I thought this meant. But I did notice, too, that is it on one of the international covers where it shows the red vein going down yeah. the front of the cover? Yeah. So that'll pop out in other editions. That's really cool.
That's the UK edition. And yeah, I think that it's actually a vein. Oh, no. In the US edition, this is cool. The title page of the US edition has a similar image, but it's a vein of marble that
oh.
the designer found. So it looks as if it could be a river or a human vein, but in fact, it's like a vein within a chunk of marble, which is also kind of cool.
I'm going to have to go back and look at my title page. Of course, my copy's downstairs, but
right.
And it's the book of the month version. So sometimes those are a little different, but we'll see if it's in there. So before we get into your book recommendations, is there a movie in the works?
There is. Yep.
That's awesome.
The book has been optioned and I wrote a screenplay for it, which was a good exercise. That's the second screenplay adaptation I've written of my work. And it's in the works. That's kind of all I can say about it.
Yeah, I know how these things go.
It's in the works. Yep.
And how do you feel about writing screenplays now that you've done two? I feel like it's probably very different, right?
Yeah, it's really different, but I'm surprised by how much I like it. It feels a little like a math problem. Like it obviously has to be a lot shorter because screenplays are 120 pages or so. And so I will say that the screenplay version of this book is very different in a lot of ways. And it's almost frustrating to write a screenplay adaptation of a book after the fact, because in writing the screenplay, you're kind of like, oh, why didn't I do that in the book? Like that, this makes so much more, like it's so much cleaner this way, or like, you know, but it was cool to sort of have new revelations about the characters and about the book in the writing of the screenplay.
But you also get a spot to get a second chance at some of those things.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I will keep my eyes peeled for more information about this. I know how these movie things take a while and stops and starts and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they can, but hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. I think it'll make a good one. All right. As usual, Liz is going to share two old books she loves, two new books she loves, one book she did not love. And this actually is not a book. It's a genre, I could say, I guess. And then one new release that she is excited about. So tell me about the first old book you love.
Sure. I absolutely love to talk about The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro, which is a book that came out, I want to say, in the early 90s. And there was a subsequent film adaptation that's really beautiful in its own right. But the book is one of the few books that I would describe as a perfect work of fiction. It's quite short. And I often teach it in my creative writing workshops because I think it's just perfect. There's not a thing I would change about it. And another amazing fact about it that I like to share with students and everyone else is that Ishiguro did a huge amount of research for it. It's the story of a very, very formal and uptight English butler in post-war England who has a very sort of muted love interest in the former housekeeper of the estate where he works. And he's sort of seeking her out again. So Ishiguro did this huge amount of research. And then he just like cloistered himself in a room practically for a month or two, I can't remember, and just wrote it from start to finish after he felt he was so firmly in the head of this character that he could just do it. And if you read about his writing process, it was just a huge amount of discipline, but also like a sprint. So it was sort of like his own version of NaNoWriMo, which is kind of funny to think about, but he did it and he produced this masterpiece that I just love. And it's a modern classic, but it's also very readable. It's so good.
And it won the Booker Prize and he won the Pulitzer. And I still have not read him. I can't believe that.
Well, that's my favorite.
This is the second Ishiguro that's been on the podcast so far. Somebody did share Never Let Me Go on an earlier episode.
Yeah, The Remains of the Day is, I like it better than Never Let Me Go, actually.
Okay, that's good to know.
That's my vote.
Well, I like the premise of this one. Mm-hmm. Magical realism is a little bit hard for me, so I know there's a little bit of that in Never Let Me Go. So that's why I've hesitated, I think. And is it a little bit like he's reflecting back on his life kind of thing as he's getting older? And I do love books like that.
Yes. Yep, that's right.
Like Mothering Sunday by Graham Swift was like that. And Lillian Boxfish Takes a Walk by Kathleen Rooney was like that. I think it just gives like a nice layer of perspective to things.
Yeah, I haven't read either of those, but that's a correct summary of The Remains of the Day. So if you like those, you might like that as well.
All right, y'all. So that was The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro. And that came out, I think it came out actually in September of 1989.
That sounds right.
All right. So tell me about the second old book you love.
This is not that old. I actually should look up what year it came out.
2016.
Heat and Light by Jennifer Haig. This is a book that is, I think, a hard sell because it's about fracking. And nobody, like, when I tell you, you should read like a 500 page long book about fracking,
no.
You will be like, no, I will never do that. But I think it's a page turner. It's very compelling. All of the characters are really well developed. And it deals with a small town in Western Pennsylvania, which is where a lot of Haig's work is set, that's experiencing the fallout from a major corporation that comes in and begins to conduct fracking. And there's the environmental fallout, but also just like the sort of paranoia that develops around it. And a lot of kind of soap opera-y subplots about love affairs and things like that. I like to recommend it because it's a hard sell. But
yes.
I think you'll be pleasantly surprised if you ever read it. And I just like Haig as a writer a lot, too.
And this is not going to make sense when I first say it, but I think it will eventually. Is it a little bit like Friday Night Lights in that it is about fracking, but it's about so much more, and it's actually not really about fracking in the sense that Friday Night Lights is about football, but it's really about so much more than that. It's about the community and the town and the people and their relationships, and football is just sort of the backdrop to all that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good comparison. Yeah, that's smart, because there's a pretty big cast of characters, but they're all pretty easy to keep straight, and I really liked it.
That'll kind of sell it to me.
Yeah.
All right. So that was Heat and Light by Jennifer Haig, and that came out back in 2016. Tell me about the first new book you love.
So I will talk about a book by Jamie Attenberg called All This Could Be Yours, which I think came out in October of 2019.
Yes.
And Jamie Attenberg is really great at writing kind of juicy tales of messed up families. And this one feels very timely because there's this tyrannical, almost, well, maybe overtly abusive patriarch who has a heart attack right at the start of the book and is sort of like taken out. And all of his family members have to deal with the repercussions of his first, I guess, coma, if I'm remembering right. And then, well, I won't spoil anything.
Yeah.
And then we figure out slowly through the course of the book, like exactly how much damage he has done throughout a couple of different generations beneath him, and the way in which his wife is both complicit in his actions and also a victim of his actions, which also feels timely to me.
Absolutely. I read this book as well, and I loved it. I love Jamie Attenberg in general, too. I've also loved All Grown Up by her, and I thought she did such a good job verbalizing these really dark feelings that, unless you've ever had a family member that's just kind of a bad seed,
mm-hmm.
then you probably really judge these people for the things that they're thinking. Like, they're not upset per se that their father is on his deathbed. And I thought she verbalized that really, really well and made you feel like they, you know, how their struggle with trying to figure out their feelings and, you know, he's your dad, but also he's not a good person. So how do you reconcile all those different feelings when you're supposed to just be flat out very, very sad and upset?
That makes a lot of sense. Like, anytime you lose a family member, your reaction can be quite different depending on like what your relationship was like with that family member.
Absolutely. And she did an awesome job with that. And I think this is a book that's maybe not for everybody because it is so, so, so dark.
Mm-hmm.
But I love dark books.
But don't you feel like she's also a really funny writer. Like,
yes.
I'll often stop and laugh at what Jamie has written. And I've read a lot of her books, actually. She has gotten to be a friend of mine because she lives full time in New Orleans now. And my sister went to medical school in New Orleans. And so every time I would go down and visit my sister, I would like hang out with Jamie too.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes, she's a really funny person live as well. And I think that like translates nicely into her writing. You can kind of hear her voice her spoken voice as she writes, which I always like.
Right. I remember All Grown Up being really funny in kind of a dark humor way.
Yeah, same. That's another book I really liked.
Yeah. And I loved that one as well. All right. So that's All This Could Be Yours by Jamie Attenberg, came out in October. And that's been on some best books of 2019 list, I feel like. I've been seeing around a little bit.
It has been. Yeah, I think that book has done pretty well.
I hope so. Tell me about the second new book you love.
The second new book I love is The Third Rainbow Girl by Emma Eisenberg. This is a work of nonfiction that I would describe as kind of a book that blends true crime and memoir. So it centers on a double murder that occurred in West Virginia in, I want to say, the early 1980s. There were two young women on their way to what was called the Rainbow Gathering, which is a group of people kind of came out of the hippie movement who just get together in some beautiful place in nature, someplace in the country, maybe every year, but at least, you know, once in a while. And they just have this like big gathering, the rainbow people do. And these two young women were hitchhiking across the United States from, I think, Tucson, Arizona, when they were tragically murdered in just short of their destination in West Virginia. And the fallout from that murder is what the book is about. And what was interesting was that initially it was assumed that local people had committed the murder. And so there's a lot in the book about assumptions about Appalachian people, their art class, and sort of regional prejudices play a huge role in the book, because eventually that assumption really comes into question, whether it was local people or somebody else. And then what I also love about the book is that Emma Eisenberg details her own time in West Virginia, where she volunteered with an organization that mentored young girls and women. And there too, she kind of talks about the culture clash that she experienced coming as an outsider into a community and trying to both respect the conventions of that community and also recognizing that some of them were problematic.
Sure.
So that's The Third Rainbow Girl. And that, I think, comes out in late January.
Yes. So by the time this episode airs, that will have just come out like a week or two before. And I had never heard of this book until you emailed it to me. And then I looked it up, and this sounds so up my alley. I love a good true crime.
Good.
And I also like it when, and tell me if she does this in the book, I like it when in a true crime book that's a part memoir, the author almost takes you on their journey of the investigation as well. And does she do that in this?
She does. She kind of narrates her discovery of this. I mean, the first time she heard about it, even while living in this community, and then also her growing interest in the crime and the way in which she investigated it herself after the fact.
That was The Third Rainbow Girl by Emma Eisenberg, and it's nonfiction, came out January 21st, so it is available now. All right, let's talk about the subgenre that you do not like, which you briefly alluded to earlier.
Yes. Okay. So I am not at all a fan of most romantic poetry, which may not sound like a controversial opinion, but it surprisingly is whenever I get into it with people. Because Keats has this ardent following, as does, I think, Poe, especially in the Northeast, where Poe lived all over the place, right, including in Philadelphia.
I'm in Richmond, Virginia, and there's a Poe museum here. Apparently, he lived here for a while. He was not born here and did not die here, but he lived here for a period.
He's like got around more than anybody. There's a Poe house in Philadelphia, in Baltimore, in New York, apparently in Richmond, which I never knew about.
So Richmond is not special.
No, everyone claims him. It's so funny. Did you know that the Baltimore Ravens, the football team, is named after Poe?
That's why they're called the Ravens?
Yes.
Oh, yep. My gosh.
So Baltimore is really trying to claim him. But anyway, a lot of undergrad students that I've taught have this very, they love Poe and they love Keats, English majors. I think because, I mean, I'm about to like insult all undergrads, which I don't mean to. I think they're so, many of them are so close to being teenagers themselves or still are teenagers that they really respond strongly to the very overt emotiveness and emotion in those poems.
Angst.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels kind of like goth. I mean, it is. Poe is very gothic.
Right.
I get it. And I think I really liked those poets too when I was a teenager and in my early 20s. And now it just feels a little bit too overt for me. Like, tone it down just a little bit with all the with all the emotion. Maybe I'll come full circle, and as I get older and older, I'll see other layers of those poems. I wouldn't put it past myself to do that, because I often will sort of like swing back and forth on movements and genres. But right now, it feels too angsty for me.
And do you read other kinds of poetry?
I do, yeah.
So you do like poetry in general, just not this?
I love poetry. In fact, when I first started writing creatively, I was writing poetry, not fiction. And I still love
interesting.
Reading okay. poetry. I don't think I'm that good at writing poetry myself. I don't do it much anymore. But I love reading it, including contemporary poetry. And for years, when I was teaching at the last school I taught at before Temple, I was teaching undergrad creative writing workshops that were multi-genre. So we always did a unit on poetry, a unit on fiction, and a unit on either creative nonfiction or screenwriting. And so I was well-versed in like teaching poetry and getting students to write poetry and things like that. So I always tried to keep up with what was going on.
Do you feel like the fact that you did write some poetry at some point really helps with your fiction writing, with your prose?
Maybe. I mean, I still think of sentences in a rhythmic way. I spend a lot of time thinking about the rhythm of my sentences, either intentionally thinking about that and trying to make them work, or maybe just subliminally writing in a way that feels rhythmic. So maybe poetry had an influence on me in that way.
Well, your writing was gorgeous in Long Bright River.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about the new release that you're looking forward to. And I will preface this with, I tried to research this book and I couldn't find it anywhere on the internet. So I feel like it's a pretty sneak peek, probably. I did find the author.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not even, since you said that, I'm not actually going to say the title of the book because I don't know if it's public yet.
Fair.
But I will say Asali Solomon's next novel, which is coming out, I believe, in maybe even 2021. That's my guess at this point. She is one of my absolute favorite writers. She has two published books. One is called Get Down, which is a collection of short stories. And the other is called Disgruntled, which is a novel. And they're both set in and around Philadelphia. And she herself lives in Philadelphia. She's a native to West Philadelphia. And she is just a really very skillful writer. I think also a really, really funny writer. I like laugh aloud when I read her writing, which is very rare for me. It takes a lot for me to actually laugh aloud, but I do with her writing. But it's also quite serious. Like, it deals with, you know, a lot of themes that I think will resonate with readers. She does coming of age really, really well. Most of the stories in Get Down are about either high schoolers or teenagers of other college students and things like that. And Disgruntled is definitely a coming-of-age novel, although it also has a second plot that deals with Frank Lloyd Wright and his butler.
Oh.
Which is a crazy true story.
I read Loving Frank.
Yeah, yeah. So Disgruntled deals with that as well.
Oh, interesting. I had no idea that that was in there.
I think Asali Solomon's work, like, I'd basically just read whatever she wrote because I think her writing is so strong. And I hope with her next book, which I know the title of, but which I will not say the title of because apparently it's not published any place online.
No, I looked.
Based on what I know about it, I think it's going to be really amazing. So get that on your radar now.
Do you know any general plot of it or kind of topic?
I do, but again, because I did not realize it wasn't published online yet. So I can't be the first to share it.
It's not even on her author website.
Yeah. Just know that she has a book coming out next year or the year, I think in 2021.
Yeah.
And get excited about it because she's great.
Well, that's exciting. I love when somebody gives a super sneak peek on the podcast of something you can't even find online. And I looked on Goodreads. I looked on Edelweiss. I looked on her author website. I Googled in general and I didn't find anything about it. So this is exciting.
Yeah, it's going to be good, I think.
And y'all, the author's name is Asali Solomon. So keep an eye out for that. And she wrote the novel Disgruntled, which I do remember coming out a couple years ago. All right. Are you ready to play Rate It?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know what it is, but I'm ready.
I like to end every episode with Rate It, and it's a lightning round game where I throw out five bookish things and you rate each thing either one or five stars. So just like you'd rate a book, but you cannot use two, three, or four stars.
Okay.
These are sort of bookish related things. Okay, number one, writing a book as a mother, since I know that Long Bright River was the first book you wrote since you became a mother.
One, for the process of doing it, because it was really, really hard. Five, for the result of having done it, because I feel like, I don't know if proud is the right word, just like very happy to know that I can actually still write as a mother.
Right. With a job too.
And I have many more thoughts on that, but I'll leave it at that.
When do you write?
I usually try to write during my work day, like Monday through Thursday, really.
Right.
Because Friday, I have both kids. But Monday through Thursday, I just try to be very disciplined about starting my work day after the kids are off to school with a writing session and then moving on to grading and lesson planning and stuff that I have to do for Temple, stuff like that.
I have two young kids. I mean, 6 and 8. So young, but getting older. I don't know how you and other writers can keep the creative energy there and flowing while doing all the mother stuff. I find that part, it takes so much mental energy to do the creative stuff.
Yeah.
And then also so much mental energy to manage the emotions of the children that I have so much respect.
Thank you. And I do also want to say, because I think people don't talk about this enough, I don't want to shame anybody else who has young kids and is like, how the hell do you find time to write? I also have a hugely supportive network of family living nearby, which I never underestimate. So
right.
My first year as a mother, I did not have nearly as much family living nearby. And that was incredibly hard. And I did very little writing that year. And now through retirement and coincidence, I have a huge number of family members living nearby who all offer like constant support. And that enables me to write much more. And so if you don't have that, I do not fault you. I think it's important also to acknowledge the support systems that are in place that enable us to work the way that we do.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And I've lived away from family, and now I live near family, and it makes such a big difference.
It does. Yep.
All right. Number two. This one's slightly controversial. So I saw in one media outlet in particular a comparison of Long Bright River to The Girl on the Train. How do you feel about that?
I will say 5 stars on that one. What I've seen is people saying that they don't actually see that as an accurate comparison.
That's
almost
how I feel.
To a one. Like, I haven't seen anybody say, like, this is a correct comparison. I think they are different books in a lot of ways. And I read The Girl on the Train and really liked it. I said 5 stars because I would be overjoyed if this book got the reception that The Girl on the Train got, as would anybody,
of course,
probably.
Right.
And also because Paula Hawkins read Long Bright River and gave an incredibly generous quote about it, which I am endlessly grateful for. So yeah, I'll say 5 stars on that one. I should be so lucky as to have the next Girl on the Train.
Yeah, I felt the way that you mentioned. I liked The Girl on the Train, but I didn't feel like Long Bright River was all that similar to it. I feel like publishers are in this trend of comparing so many mysteries or thrillers to The Girl on the Train. I see that comparison come up these days and I'm like, again, really? Like,
yeah. I will say this, which is maybe a bit more explanation. My editor at Riverhead, Sarah McGrath, was the editor of The Girl on the Train.
Okay.
You know, when the book went out on submission and I started speaking to editors, she wrote me this really amazing letter in which she said, this will sound like, you know, I don't want to flatter myself, but she basically was like, I only have this reading experience once every so often. And the last time I felt this way about a book was about The Girl on the Train. And so I think it is partly due to that. I don't want to say coincidence, but,
sure,
you know, she was the editor of The Girl on the Train as well. So that's maybe why they come up for comparison so often.
Yes, I had forgotten that, about that connection. All right, number three. writing about a city that you are not a new resident of, but I guess relatively, you didn't grow up there, I guess is what I'm saying. How do you feel about that? Was that, were you nervous or excited, or how did that feel for you?
I think, yeah, there are a bit of nerves. On the other hand, like, I have lived here for a decade at this point, and I married Philadelphian, and, you know, both my kids are Philadelphian, and I have no intention of leaving Philadelphia. Right. So it kind of feels like by marriage and by intention, I'm not a born and bred local for sure, but I feel like I've earned my stripes as a Philadelphian. So we'll see. I'm sure there are some Philadelphians who will think differently for sure. And, you know, they're not wrong. I'll never have like the experience of having been born here and grown up here. So in that sense, that's research. But I love Philadelphia. I'm a big ambassador for it, and I talk it up all the time. So I hope that I do it justice.
So a resounding 5 stars.
Yes.
All right. Number 4, the book Mystic River by Dennis Lehane. And the reason that I have this in here is that I read it kind of close to when I read Long Bright River, and they reminded me so much of each other. Like I mentioned, The Girl on the Train, the book that popped out in my head as the comp to Long Bright River is Mystic River.
I love Dennis Lehane's work too. And I have a special affection for his books because they're set in Boston, which is the city I did grow up near to. And yeah, I think he does such a remarkable job of conjuring place and making you feel invested in character, and also doing that thing we were talking about of like reveals that feel earned. I think he's kind of a master of that. And he too read this book and gave a generous quote. So I saw that, a fan of his for that reason. So yeah, so I think that's a flattering comp, and I'm glad you thought that. 5 stars.
Awesome. Yeah. And I felt like in the whole vein of literary police procedural, where I don't feel like there's a ton of those out there, Long Bright River and Mystic River both fall in that category for me, which is a little bit of a small pool, which I wish the pool would grow.
Yeah. Tana French is in there too. I love her writing. She's just great.
And Angie Kim as well for Miracle Creek.
I haven't read Angie Kim yet. Is that a police procedural, or is that a literary mystery?
Not a police procedural, a little bit maybe, but she focuses more on the courtroom part of it.
Okay.
So I would say maybe a literary courtroom drama.
Yeah, I'll have to read it.
All right, number 5, thrillers in general. Like, are you a big thriller reader in your pleasure reading?
Maybe more along the lines of the authors we were talking about. I love Tana French. I love Dennis Lehane. I like a lot of books that incorporate mystery in a character-driven way. So yeah, those are the books that I absolutely love. When I was in high school, I went through a phase of reading like every Agatha Christie book I could get my hands on, and then other like British lady mystery writers as well.
Right.
I thought they were really smart and clever and kind of like pleasurable to read too. So it's funny with Mickey's voice, she's so formal and sort of prides herself on her vocabulary, but is also very socially awkward and stilted. And without realizing it, I think a lot of those like British lady mystery writers kind of came out through the voice of this 32-year-old working class Philadelphian.
Oh, interesting.
Even though I don't know if Mickey would see herself that way. But halfway through the book, I was like, oh, maybe that's what's happening. All those years of reading Agatha Christie in high school are like coming
good
out through
inspiration.
This other character. Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's funny. Thank you so much for being on. This has been a wonderful discussion. I feel privileged to be able to talk to you in more depth about such an awesome book that, y'all, if you haven't read Long Bright River yet and you do like these kind of suspenseful mysteries kind of mashed in with something else, I really recommend this one for you. Tell everybody where they can find you online before we go.
Sure. My website is lizmoore.net. My Twitter handle is lizmoorebooks. And that's also my Instagram handle, lizmoorebooks. Thank you so much for having me. Great questions. This was really fun.
Thank you. Everyone, the February Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Liz's picks for categories like Favorite Literary Mystery and Best Book About Addiction. If you'd like to get this bonus episode plus other bonus episodes, including my latest edition, which is me doing the regular podcast book recommendation format in a solo monthly episode, you can support the show for $5 a month on Patreon. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. Next week will be a mini episode featuring podcast patron Aubrey Chaudle. And she is otherwise known on Instagram as @MNReadingMam. Talk to you next week. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.